It begins, as it must, with breath. Sonically, psychically, emergency was once situated between the gasp and the scream. Sudden inhalation and piercing exhalation. The sirens of Homeric epic were also situated between the outflung and indrawn, their song as much sigh as solicitation. The deep sigh of two historian creatures, thoroughly aware of the barbarities of war, the travails of Odysseus, the entire annals of suffering. We know all things that come to pass on this fertile earth. Surely, then, they also know that they shall remain alone, and most torturous to any historian, unenlightening. At each approach of strange ears within acoustic range of their flowering meadow on an island that is prelude to Scylla and Charybdis, the sirens sing honey-sweet sounds that are more than melismata. They are entreaty. Draw near. Bring your ship to rest. Listen to our voices. What they would share, alas, is an opera with more acts than any mortal can bear. So all who fail to stop their ears with beeswax must drown following the song to shore or starve beside divas who want nothing other than to be heard out. Won't you listen? Even Odysseus, who listens for as long as it takes to sail past, grasps only the feeling of grasping after, which is, of course, his Odyssey. Now, Bronze Age Homer gave the two sirens a place, but no faces, voice, but no gender, a name binding them together, but anonymous as the rope, seiren, that bound Odysseus. The Greco-Roman world compounded them as bird and or fish and woman. Latin Christians dragged them out to sea, confounding them with harpy mermaids, or clawed, ruinous harpies alone. Eastern Christians flung them into the air as hybrid angels and birds of paradise, or muddied them as devious water spirits, rusalka. Africans from Tanzania across to Senegal and Haiti heard the merwoman, Mamiwata, offer wealth or fertility in return for fidelity. Won't you listen? Everywhere, from Japan to Laos to India to the Caribbean, sirens had human heads and lyric mouths. But in Europe, their song was most keyed to urgency, to imperatives of lust, nostalgia, and an overwhelming need to know. Well before they were given mechanical hearts, sirens were heard from afar as agents of shipwreck and drowning. Closer up, their song was emergency. Won't you listen? Never fear to do good works and never let good men be terrified. Be early cautioned before the siren voice of the deceiver overcomes you. Learn to know it before it whispers in your ear. This siren voice speaks no word of justice, duty, law. It speaks only of passion, which knows no law. Thus, Johann Caspar Lavater, a Swiss Calvinist minister famed as a physiognomist who calendared character from faces, warning his congregation in Zurich against French imperial rhetoric while under Napoleonic occupation in 1799. The siren voice, he went on, calls public violence cunning, the most unmitigated despotism, necessary measures, and the utter disregard of the safety of individual security, a means of protection for their safety. The siren voices dare to speak of higher politics, of righteous political reasons, and when it has finally to acknowledge that certain things are hard and unrighteous in themselves, it yet attempts to call them necessary evils. Reports of his sermon enraged a French grenadier who necessarily shot Lavater, whose wounds never healed. He died at the dawn of a new century, the 2nd of January, 1801, resisting all siren calls to a state of emergency. Two millennia earlier, the Roman Senate already had protocols for appointing a dictator with unfettered, if explicitly interim, powers in moments of peril, war, plague, sedition. The Republic averaged one emergency dictator every 6 years for 500 years. Hellenistic cities under siege regularly issued emergency money using shards of pottery. Later European towns under siege used scraps of leather or linen. States of emergency, states of siege, emergency edicts, emergency hearings, emergency money. Species of emergency had become so common by the 1700s that the very word, like urgence in French and Notstand in German, required ramifying adjectives before it could command any attention. Not just emergency, but unusual emergency, great emergency, extraordinary emergency, sudden emergency. Sudden. That was crucial. Running at an oblique angle for millennia had been the notion of crisis. Whether in politics, medicine, economics, theater, or religion, crisis was felt to be more organic and inflected than emergency, with a formulaic relationship to the onset and resolution of illness or conflict, of stage drama and dramas of conversion. In English and Romance languages, where the word for emergency arose from emergence, it was excusably conflated with crisis. But by 1755 and the sudden upheaval of the Lisbon quake, tsunami, and fires in 2 days, emergency as a noun almost completely lost its anchorage in the emergent. With one exception, quite odd, that I hold in suspense, emergency would henceforth erupt. Eruptive, it was interruptive and an imperative to act, because you could act and you should. Read dozens of 18th century treatises on benevolence. Practice that neologism, humanitarian. Listen to sermons parsing the Good Samaritan parable as a personal and social model. By technocultural promise and ethical premise, an emergency then was actionable. Something could be done, and you could do it. Now, otherwise it would be too late. Check your new pulse watch, your inexpensive pocket watch. By 1755, emergency was a menacing, time-critical event or condition that could be deterred if you intervened instantly, confidently, capably. While physicians, diplomats, and financiers might wait out a crisis to see where things were headed, an enlightened individual was someone equal to an emergency, to any emergency, adept at confronting the press of circumstance with quick insight and deft action. Apoplectic attacks were not yet emergencies, because little could be done for someone suffering a stroke. The early stages of drownings were emergencies, timed to the minute and publicly acknowledged as such by the first ordinances and associations in Europe that urged strangers to come to the help of the drowning and rewarded them for perseverance, even if the rescue ultimately failed. By 1790, detailed instructions on how to retrieve and resuscitate a drowning person had been posted beside rescue kits secured along riverbanks across Europe and colonial English America. Now, drownings, of course, recall us to sirens. None of the 1790 posted sheets told rescuers how to drown out a siren's song. But as emergency veered from the gentler arc of crisis toward the jagged and precipitous, sirens slipped from their moorings in sad omniscience and fatal allure to become an apparatus of science, science, and then a mode of prescience or prescience, known also as alarm. In the same year, 1799, that Lavater in Zurich preached against the siren's voice, John Robison in Edinburgh crafted a device demonstrating how musical tones are fluctuations of air producing sound waves controlled for frequency. In this case, the flow of a column of air regularly interrupted and channeled. Robison, however, neither named nor mythologized this first mechanical siren. He reserved his own mythologizing for the Illuminati, that shadowy international cabal against which he fought to his dying breath in 1805. Naming the device was left to a later post-Napoleonic, post-paranoid generation. In specific, to Charles Cagnard de la Tour, a Parisian engineer intent on improving the vocal qualities of a speaking machine capable of humanoid sounds. He might reasonably have called this La Sirène. Instead, he bestowed the name upon another of his 1819 devices, one capable of producing regular tones using currents of air or water. Adding a system of dials, he transformed Robison's device into an instrument that could determine the number of vibrations corresponding to a sound of any pitch, clocking, therefore, the high buzz of a mosquito at 10,000 flutters per second. Like Robison, Cagnard de la Tour meant his sirène for laboratories, for experimental environments. From an environmental perspective, sirens were now being freed up for scientific experiment and civil locution by an ecological disaster, loss of habitat. With the advent of marine chronometers that enabled more accurate ocean navigation and cartography, with broader trade routes plied by swift clippers than plowed by steamships, with undersea telegraphic cables, with nations erecting hundreds of lighthouses beaming brighter lights reflected by Fresnel lenses, and with the onset of warmer weather at the end of the Little Ice Age in Europe, opening up polar regions, the waters where siren mermaids might hide and sing were vanishing. Their last resorts were fog-shrouded straits and shoals, illustrated volumes of folktales, and museums hung with Pre-Raphaelite paintings. But what modern mariners, ship owners, and insurers desired was no song of erotic communion, but an acoustic beacon that could be heard farther and more steadily through fog or squall than any light could be seen for fending emergencies. Cagnard de la Tour himself had proposed La Sirène as a maritime signal, but such agency was left for yet another generation, for Joseph Henry in Washington, D.C. His research program of 1865 to 77 proved the sonic superiority of steam-powered sirens over coastal cannon, foghorns, and steam whistles. One of the mechanical siren's supposed defects had been that at louder volumes, it lost its musicality and became so shrill it screamed. Such piercing sound, of course, was advantageous in a beacon for vessels nearing enshrouded coasts where most shipwrecks occurred and most drownings. How advantageous that peculiar scream has been understood for less than a decade. In the same year that La Sirène was put through its first etudes, the German physiologist Karl Burdach located two small almond-shaped bodies, Mandelkern, in the temporal lobe. And during the same years that Joseph Henry tracked the redemptive powers of sirens, a Viennese neuroanatomist, Theodor Meinert, began tracing the functions of these Mandelkern, or in Greek, amygdala. Finally, in 2015, neurobiologists in Geneva, Manhattan, and Frankfurt showed that the acoustic profile of the human scream, paralleled by the profile of steam-powered sirens, yields exactly that rough temporal modulation spectrum most likely to prompt the amygdala to send distress signals to the hypothalamus to get the adrenal glands pumping. In brief, the shrillness of La Sirène, like a scream, shoves your body into emergency mode, where mind, nerve, hormones, heart, and muscles tussle. Fight, take flight, or freeze. So, as a modern warning apparatus that prompts a physiological state of emergency, the ancient sirens had their emergency song, "Won't You Listen?" transposed to another key. Once honeyed, now strident. Listen! Once lulling, now anxious or terrifying. Listen! Once seductive, now imperious. Listen! The siren's sisterhood with danger was also dramatically reversed. Their song no longer pleading with you to come near, rather demanding that you make way, pull over, find shelter. No longer asking that you rest an indeterminate while, rather insisting that you run for cover, grab your go bag. And no longer even appearing to offer serenity and knowledge, rather warning of imminent cataclysm or adverting to a disaster that happened moments ago just out of sight, unsettling the present and the future. And if it is still true, 2,800 years ago and now, that coming too close to a siren, you lose your hearing, and in extremis, your breath, it is no longer true that jeopardy always attaches to the song of a siren. Sirens may sound in all clear. Jeopardy may attach to their absence. Is it apocalypse or post-apocalypse or a new harmony when sirens go eerily silent? What of sirens lying abandoned, as in Orizatsu's film at Fukushima? Further amplified and electrified, the siren has also been lifted away from water to sit squat on rooftops and poles, enjoying you to flee or hunker down before cyclone, hurricane, tornado, earthquake, air raid, rocket attack, nuclear accident. Bolted to police cars, fire engines, ambulances, enjoining you to make way for others who, in your stead, will fight off criminals, flames, and invaders. And sometimes, a siren means for you to hold still, as antiphonal prelude to national minutes of silence in memoriam of armistice or Holocaust. Multivocal and equivocal, sirens this century are more akin to the Homeric Circe, that bird sorceress and shapeshifter who warned Odysseus against the sirens and told him how he might listen to them while moving on. Most of us daily do the same thing. We move on. We hear the scream songs of sirens and often ignore them. Sirens, for example, at intersections far away. Sirens in stadiums. Sirens bleating of their own malfunction. This is our daily sonic triage of emergency. Triage. All beings sort for priority in living and life-saving. But over the last 7,091,000,000 seconds since the Napoleonic campaigns of the French military physician Larrey, triage has been so systematized in milieus of war, epidemic, and catastrophe that it has become a defining act and sign of emergency. Whom do you choose to save? Medics now follow a standard 10-second triage alphabet, checking A, airway, B, breathing, C, circulation and shock, D, disability, seizure, meningitis, intoxication, E, exposure to heat, cold, radiation, smog, or noise. At mass casualty events, medics shift to colored tags. Red, instant attention, resuscitate. Yellow, urgent. Green, stable. Black, dying. Nothing to be done, which is oddly called also expectant. In some triage systems, yellow is also known as emergent, as in symptoms may become life-threatening. In the Chinese four-tiered system of triage, emergent means instead, no life-threatening issues, treatment may be deferred. If emergent itself is in need of triage, obviously, consider this brief ABC of today's emergency lexicon. Emergency aid, appendectomy, architecture for refugees. Emergency brakes, broadcast systems and buttons. Emergency calls, clauses, contacts, contraception, custody hearings. Commercially, systematically, cinematically, emergency has been vitiated or overplayed. Emergency bow tie instructions. Emergency intense hair treatment. Emergency vitamin packs. Emergency self-destruct systems. So banal is emergency that it does not feel oxymoronic to speak of routine or minor emergencies. And just now, under the impress of global warming and an oily, sanctimoniously greenwashed late capitalism, it does not seem unreasonable to speak of slow emergency, long emergency, endless emergency. Is it any surprise that the range of our sirens cannot keep up with the range of our emergencies? Vice versa, where on our ladders of triage does a siren yelp, growl, whoop? What sort of emergency do you hear at a siren's rumble? Or the Gestapo two-tone? What does it mean to listen to sirens once we expect neither lyricism, nor wisdom, nor shipwreck? In our era of superabundant ear emergencies, we might listen to sirens in a naively prefatory way as vital alerts, solicitous omens, or in a predatory way, sirens producing a viral sound field of precarity, a feeling of vulnerability so pervasive that we buy into doorbell surveillance cameras, AI sentries, personal protective gear, backup generators, Armageddon shelters, closed borders. Or in a paranoid way, sirens as a conspiracy of screams meant to drive us crazy in our vigilance, or crying wolf so often that we become oblivious to actual threats. Or in a paranormal way, sirens as messages that have somehow made it through the fog of time or space, from a lingering past or a retrograde future, telling us what must be done now. Or in a preemptive way, as waveforms at different registers, opening out to sound passages where escape is neither narrow nor unnerving, where there is, in some words and out other words, no emergency. Not because nothing can be done, that double negative, but because most everything is in the offing. In, check the airways. Out, breath. All clear? Will you? Won't you? Listen?
Thank you so much, Hillel, for this amazing contribution. I'd like to pass the word to Mazen.